Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches. Hello and welcome to Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and with me on the line from Weber County is USU's Extension Horticulturist, Jerry Goodspeed. And we hope you'll call with your questions or comments to 1-800-826-1495. You can also email us your question at upraccess@gmail.com or tweet us a question at hashtag AUGarden. Jerry, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, this summer has been completely pretty much different than the last two summers.
Isn't that incredible how much that changes?
Yeah, in Utah, it's just usually never the same. I'm going to start out asking one question, though. I have seen, and I was hoping that the populations would be down, but these stinking grasshoppers are just driving me nuts. And I'm seeing more and more each year. I don't know why they were delayed coming into my garden this year, but they're just eating up everything, and it doesn't matter what bait I put out. I guess I'm just going to have to do mechanical picking. Is there anything else to take care of them?
No, especially when they get, you know, we find that if we can control them when they're a little bit smaller, it's a little bit easier, but once they get some size on them, it's real hard to control. You know, commercially, the commercial baits are available. Those with seven in them are Carbaryl. There's always the, you know, the bacteria, the Nolo, organic control as well, but both the Nolo especially, that's a very slow acting process. You have to be doing it, you know, year after year after year into where they're breeding and stuff and laying their eggs. So,
well, how do you know where they're coming from? I know for me, I've got a lot of lawn, but then I also have my big garden plot, but it gets tilled up several times a year.
My guess is they're coming from somewhere else off property. Normally, it's a site that isn't disturbed, so a field, a vacant lot, and they can move quite a distance. So
would a pasture be enough?
Could be. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, well, that's what's abutting my property. So
there you go. Now you know.
Well, I have wondered if the only way to take care of them is either, and I usually pick them off, I'll go out at night with the flashlight and pick them off and hand them to my chickens the next morning.
There you go.
But is there anything that you can spray on your ornamentals to keep them from eating?
That's a good question. I don't know off the top of my head if there's something that's really going to be effective.
I wondered if anything that has the, is it capsaicin? What, I can't remember how to pronounce it.
Yeah,
from
peppers
that you could spray
the
on.
Hot pepper. You know, it's worth a try. I am not an expert on grasshoppers, but besides the fact knowing that once they get any size at all, they're very hard to control, I know. But it'd be worth a try. I mean,
of course, you wouldn't want to spray it on your raspberries because then your raspberries will be.
They wouldn't taste real well.
They have a different taste to them, exactly. Well, the main issue with most gardens this summer is related to heat.
Yep.
And I'm sure you're getting a lot of questions and seeing a lot of heat damage. As far as the vegetable garden is concerned, what does heat damage look like? I mean, because sometimes you might have one problem and it's actually another.
Well, I know on, for instance, tomatoes is where we see a lot of it. Of course, the tomato itself will get sunburned, but the leaves themselves will start to turn, be kind of splotchy, a mottled look, if you will, to them. That's kind of more common what I see, especially the older leaves. The newer leaves will come out green, and then as they as the plant matures, the older leaves will get a little bit mottled, will get, you know, the other thing is summer scorch around the edges of the leaves. You'll see that. And those are some of the things that we're seeing.
Is it mostly just a matter of not watering correctly?
I think so. I think quite often what we do, we have a tendency to water too often, too shallow. I especially on vegetables, I tell people the example of the commercial growers or the the grower, the truck farmer that has 5 acres of tomatoes, and he gets his water every 6.5 days. But when he does water, he floods it, and the water goes really deep. You know, you're looking at 9, 10, 12 inches into the soil where that water is going to be found for those tomatoes. And they're able to survive quite well, and they do quite well because they have that deep water and a lot of water reserve, whereas most homeowners, you know, they're going to water it maybe 1 or 2 inches at the most. They're going to turn on a sprinkler and leave it on for an hour. And in reality, you know, you're just not getting a very deep penetration of water.
So
they're watering every day just an inch or so, and it's just not an inch into the soil, not an inch of water, but an inch into the soil.
So if you don't have access to flood irrigation, is the drip the way to go?
It's a good way. Just make sure that you leave it on long enough to get a very deep penetration. Yep.
And about how long is long enough?
Boy, you know, that's one of those questions, like, I've had it explained to me once where you walk into a bar and the bartender says, what'll you have? And you say something like, I'll have a half hour of beer. Well, it just depends on what kind of a drinker you are. And the same thing with when people ask me how long, you know, it just kind of depends on what kind of system you have. What I tell them usually is water it until you're getting a good 8 to 10 inches of penetration into the soil.
So just dig down into the soil to see how long it takes to get in?
Or take a screwdriver and push it down through, and it'll slide right in when it's wet soil, and then it'll stop when it hits dry.
Well, I suppose it also depends on what type of soil you've got. I mean, if you've got
That's true. Yep.
more clay, well, it's going to hold on to the moisture better than a lot of rocks and gravel.
Than a sandy soil. Mm-hmm. That's true.
Okay. Well, as far as the heat damage is concerned, is there anything you can do to mitigate? I mean, you can't control the heat. You can control when you water, but as far as keeping those plants a little bit more happy, what can you do?
Nothing really. Just make sure that what you had said, just make sure that you're getting the correct amount of water, that you're getting a deep watering and not every day. I mean,
Could you put on a mulch?
People wanting to go out there and water every day, and I want to tell them, no, that's not what your plants want. They want a deep watering. But that's about it. That's what's going to keep them happy.
Can you put on a mulch?
That can help, yep. I do, for a couple reasons. One is to conserve water, but another is to reduce weed growth.
So do you use, like, a black plastic mulch? Should you use the weed barrier?
No, not in a garden. What I use in a garden is more of just an organic mulch that I can later till in. I love compost as a mulch.
So just a couple inches on the top? A couple inches on the top of the soil?
One of the tricks that I kind of like to use is we'll right after we plant our plants or right after they're coming up, we'll take some newspaper, one or two sheets, and place it down around the plants and in the rows, and then we'll cover that with a compost, and that'll keep the weeds out for just about the whole summer.
Super. Well, we'd like to have you call with your questions or comments. It's 1-800-826-1495. Jerry Goodspeed, USU Extension Horticulturist, is on the line with us from Weber County. And you can also tweet us your question at hashtag AUGarden or email us your question at upraccess@gmail.com. Well, one of the things, Jerry, that I was thinking about this past week that we could talk about would be shrubs. And particularly what shrubs might be a little more drought tolerant for our yards, maybe people would consider. I was at a Cub Scout day camp up the canyon there on the way to Monte Cristo, and they were pointing out various shrubs, and a lot depended on, you know, what part of the landscape they were in. But I thought, you know, a lot of these could translate to home gardens, home yards. But what you see a lot in the stores are things that come from outside the state. So what sorts of shrubs do you recommend?
Well, there's what you said is very true. You know, we like to get shrubs that are adapted to our area, and we know that the native shrubs are very adapted to our area. But there are others out there besides the natives that adapt very well. But some of the problem is exactly what you say. We try to bring in some shrubs that are not acclimated to a very dry, very hot, basically a desert climate, especially when we have cold winters and hot summers. I mean, it's a very harsh environment that we have, and sometimes we bring a shrub in from, you know, from the coast that's used to being babied. You know, it's never very hot, never very cold, always moist, and bring it here and then wonder why it struggles or why it you know, why it doesn't do as well. As far as, you know, some of the native shrubs, there are quite a few of them out there, in my opinion, that are quite beautiful, and I think we should use them a little bit more.
I know one that I've seen a lot in the last 10, 15 years are the burning bushes, and I don't know, for me, I've kind of gotten away from them, mostly because everyone else is planting them, and I tend to like to plant what's not everyone else isn't planting, but
I'm with you.
I've noticed that they are not what I would call drought tolerant. I mean, I've seen some of them just kind of fry right up in this kind of heat.
Yeah, and they have other problems as well. I agree with you there. I think that if we're going to use burning bush, we need to use them very sparingly and in the right setting. They have a number of problems. In my opinion, their average life is probably around 7 years, 10 years at the most. And that's not true. I've seen them live longer than that, but they are very sensitive to our conditions. A lot of root rot we get on them when people try to overwater them to keep them moist. They take a little bit more nitrogen to make them look good. And yeah, I don't believe that that's one of the better shrubs either.
What are some other shrubs that you would try to avoid? I mean, it's kind of like we have a tree list. It's like, don't plant aspens.
I don't know. That's a good question. What are some of the problem plants? In my opinion, one of them that is way overplanted and that we see everywhere would be the Alberta spruces, the little conical shaped shrubs that everybody loves to plant that have a lot of winter damage and get mites, get summer scorch, get a lot of different problems on them, and yet I see them planted. I mean, you can't walk around a neighborhood without having a dozen of them there.
And it seems like once they get chewed by the deer or damaged in some way, they just don't like to green back up.
No,
in years
they
to
don't.
Come.
They are not, in my opinion, a very good shrub for our location. Although, how many of them are out there, I'm just amazed at. Somebody made a mint on that.
And is that just an example of that's what happens to be available in the stores? That's what people plant?
Uh-huh. Yep, that's a good point. It's very interesting to what I believe happens is, you know, the nursery industry, when you plant something, you're forecasting it for up to, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years in the future to see if you're going to sell it. So if there's a glut of them on the market, when the normal consumer goes in to buy a shrub, they're going to look for something that's kind of cute and something that's inexpensive or on sale. And boy, these are all over on the market, and without doing the research and finding out about the plant, then it's really easy just to buy what's inexpensive and looks good to you at the time.
So if you're in the market for getting a shrub, what resources would you go to look at, you know, what might work well in my yard?
Well, go to a local nursery, not a large-scale what do they call them, big box or something. Normally the local nurseries are going to be carrying more of the produce or more of the plants that are going to be adaptable to our area. And they normally have a little more resources as far as knowledge. They've worked in the industry a little bit more. They're familiar with the surroundings. So I tell most people that's probably the best thing to do is just go to a local nursery and talk to them about some of the shrubs. And then, you know, learn about them. The other thing I tell people is walk around your neighborhood, walk around your town, start looking around and noticing plants that are doing well. And, you know, if you don't know what it is, you can ask the homeowner. You can take a sample, bring it into the extension office. We'll try to identify it, or we usually can identify it for you. And that lets you know, yeah, that plant does well here. It's been doing good in this location for many, many years. And botanical gardens, you know, we have a garden in Ogden. We have a garden in Kaysville with the university. Plus, there are other places throughout the state, Red Butte Gardens, Thanksgiving Point. There's one down in St. George where you can go, and they're growing a lot of these shrubs where they've been growing for a while, and you can take a look at them. A lot of them are labeled and find out that if it's going to do what you want it to do, if it's doing well in the area, those types of things.
Doesn't the Jordan Water Conservation District office have a lot of natives planted around?
Yeah, that's another excellent one. Yep.
Okay. Well, let's look at a couple of what you would call more drought-tolerant or native plants. one of the ones I looked at when I was up the canyon was one of the maples, and the scout that was giving the lecture, I think he was about 16, he says, "This is a sugar maple, and you can get sugar or maple syrup from."
Did you want to correct him and say,
"Oh, yes, I did." Well,
maple.
I eventually sent in an email that said, "You might want to get this corrected." But yeah, I mean, it's hard because you go up the canyon and you look, and if you don't know any better, I probably thought they were maples, sugar maples, when I was his age as well. But beautiful trees, beautiful color. Can they be grown in the valley landscape?
Oh yeah, the big toothed maple is probably what you were seeing up there. Very nice maple. Dr. Larry Rupp has done some research, and within the next year or two, there'll be a number of big tooth maples on the market that are a little more tight. In other words, they're not; the shape is a little better. They have better fall color. A couple of them maybe are more upright. So these plants are beautiful for our landscapes, and they do well, and they give you a wonderful fall color. We've got in Kaysville a number of them growing out on our property that. Just spectacular trees. Yeah, and that's one that I would recommend. It's not a it is a tree, but it's not an overwhelmingly tall tree. It gets 12 to 15 feet tall. Very nice for most landscapes. I think that's a great choice.
So you could grow like a large shrub.
You could
if you wanted to.
Yep.
And I have to recommend as you have, Jerry, your gardens down there. It's been very helpful for me, especially as I was looking at native. Flowering plants. I wanted to see what was growing in August and September, and it's just spectacular what you've got down there.
Well, thanks. Yeah, it's a resource for the whole state to come, and that's the point is to show you, and then you can look at it. You know, a lot of times people say, "Well, come to me and say, well, what's the best shrub?" And you know, I can tell you what I like, but I can't tell you what you're going to like, and so that's why I think it's so cool to have these. Botanical gardens and other resources that we have to go to get a good look at them and be able to see what they look like, how they're doing, how tall they grow, what the mature shape is like. And I agree with you. I love that.
What about some other even more drought-tolerant shrubs? Is it a fern leaf bush?
Uh-huh. Fern bush.
Yep. Yeah, I've got one of those, and I have yet to water it this summer, and it seems to be doing just fine.
Yep, that's one that's very drought tolerant. The leaves look like a fern. It has a white flower. Yours should be in bloom about now.
It is.
I'm going to say that it's one of the few shrubs that's blooming in the heat of the summer, usually in July, August, we get a good bloom on it. We find also that if we cut them back a little bit, they can get a little bit airy looking, more so than people want, but we found that if we start cutting them back, boy, they'll just thicken right up and very drought-tolerant plant, yeah. In fact, it's really nice for some people that have areas that, like you said, they don't water at all, but they want a planting or they want a screen or something that'll... And it can get up to, I've seen them up to, you know, 6, 7, 8 feet tall.
Is that when they get a little bit more water, when they can get that tall?
No, I've seen some out in Nevada about that tall.
Oh, okay. So when would you cut them back?
In the spring.
And so just before they start to open up?
Yeah, grow out, yeah.
And then how far would you cut them back?
Well, we've done a little bit. We've done some where we cut them right back to the ground, and they've come right back. And then others, we've just kind of selectively pruned them back a little bit, you know, kind of look at the older canes and see which ones are a little more leggy than we like, and we'll just cut those back, and then they'll come get some new growth on them.
So that tends to fill them in a little bit more?
It does, yeah, and which we've liked the shape of that a little bit better.
What about Apache plume?
Another nice shrub. Really, although it does have a flower on it, mostly they grow it for the plume, the seed head, which, how would you describe that? Looks like a...
Well, it reminds me of a feather.
Yeah, or I just thought of... the Lorax, the trees in the Lorax.
Oh, the truffula trees?
The truffula.
Yeah,
looks
there you
like
go.
The top. really nice and holds that for a couple of months. Another plant that you wouldn't have to water. And it does have a nice bloom on it when it does bloom in the spring, late or early summer. But it's the plume that most people enjoy.
And how do you get that one to look nice? I know, is that also one that you need to cut back a little bit?
Yeah, you'd have to just be working with it a little bit and pruning it back to get it to thicken. It is naturally a little bit airier plant. I call them airy instead of leggy.
Yeah, I noticed that with mine. But again, I love it because I don't have to water it. It just keeps going on its own.
It's just a beautiful plant that just takes off and does well, doesn't it?
Any other suggestions for some natives?
Well, mountain mahogany is another one that I like. A little leaf mountain mahogany. Don't need to water it. If you water them, they'll do a little bit better, but they're a native plant. You don't have to water them all. They'll get upwards of, I've seen them almost reach 10 feet tall. Typically in a landscape, they'll get around 6 feet tall. Can make, a lot like what you would expect in a really dry area as a background shrub. That's one that I like.
Are they typically ones that you see on the gravelly south slopes
of
the mountains?
Yeah, they'll grow about anywhere without any water at all.
Wow, and how long are the leaves?
They're very small leaves.
Okay,
very small.
So that's part of the adaptation for the plant in order to get by without a lot of water?
It is, yeah.
Okay.
And again, it's not one that I would put right next to my front door to make it beautiful, but it is sure a nice plant as a background plant, one that's going to soften areas and one that once you plant, you don't have to worry about.
Are there any that you would encourage for wildlife, ones that you would like to plant to attract, especially I would say like birds?
Well,
don't necessarily want to attract deer. So
I mean, there are some, the native junipers, the Utah juniper, the Rocky Mountain juniper. They do have a seed on them. Birds will come in on them, and they can find cover in them. That's a good question off the top of my head. Those would be the ones that come to mind quickly. Anything that they can find cover in and find a little bit of food in.
Isn't there a Utah serviceberry?
Yeah, that's an excellent one too. Yeah, along with that, we have the golden currant, which is another native that has a fruit on it that they'll enjoy. The serviceberries are good. And, I love the serviceberries. They have beautiful fall color, a nice bloom when they're in flower. They have a fruit on them that looks nice but is also edible, and I even eat them. But the birds will come. If you can get them before the birds will get to them, you can eat them.
Do they actually have a pretty good flavor?
Yeah, they're not bad. I don't mind them.
So they're not quite as bad as choke cherries.
Oh, no. They're sweeter than that. Yeah. No, I'll go out and eat them in the garden.
Now, our neighbors planted some choke cherries, and some of them hang over my fence. And so I thought, well, I'll try some of these one year. And I let them get really dark and black, and I took a bite, and I've never had anything so astringent in my mouth ever.
Well, they say you just have to add enough sugar to it, and I think that's about a couple pounds per berry on that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you're listening to Access Utah. Jerry Goodspeed is USU's Weber County Extension horticulturist, and if you'd like to join our program, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. You can also tweet us at #AUGarden and then also email us at upraccess@gmail.com. We're going to go to the latest edition of Wild About Utah right now, but we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with the rest of the program and Jerry Goodspeed and taking your questions.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
Hi, this is Mark Larez Casanova from the Utah Master Naturalist Program at Utah State University Extension. Prior to settlement by the pioneers at the end of the 19th century, wildfires were relatively common throughout the mountains of Utah. Wildfires were a result of natural disturbance such as lightning strikes, but many were purposely set by Native Americans. Wildfires restarted the cycle of forest succession and also created a mosaic of plant communities across the landscape. Although Utah's changing climate has had a major influence, human factors have considerably altered the natural fire regime over the past 150 years. Fire frequency slowly declined prior to settlement by the pioneers due to a period of global cooling. However, fire activity increased considerably to its highest point during the settlement period between 1856 and 1909. This increase was linked to the dramatic growth in human population and activity, which led to increased surface fuel from extensive timber harvesting and inevitably to more ignition sources for more frequent fires. Between 1910 and 1990, there was a dramatic decline in wildfires throughout Utah, despite the gradual increase in global temperatures. This was due to intensive livestock grazing, habitat fragmentation as a result of development, agricultural expansion, and effective fire suppression. As a result, shade-intolerant trees that relied on fire for regeneration, such as aspen and lodgepole pine, were often replaced by long-lived, shade-tolerant trees such as spruce and fir. In general, this resulted in a gradual decline in diversity of plant communities. As a result, more homogeneous forests that are densely populated with trees and accumulated fuels are more susceptible to intense fires that burn hotter and are more difficult to control. In 2007, Utah had a record-setting fire season that burned over 629,000 acres, including the 363,000-acre Milford Flat Fire. We're halfway through the fire season this year, and approximately 400,000 acres have burned in Utah, costing over $47 million to control. Additionally, wildfires that have burned about three-quarters of the acreage this year were classified as large in size. It seems that increased temperatures, decreased snowpack, and a century of land use and management has resulted in a dangerous wildfire situation in Utah and much of the West. It will take some creative management strategies, such as sustainable timber harvesting or prescribed fires, to tackle this ongoing issue if we want to limit the risk and cost of larger and more frequent wildfires. For Wild About Utah, I'm Mark Larez Casanova.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah comes from the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Information is at cnr.usu.edu.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by Utah Festival Opera and Musical Theater presenting performances of My Fair Lady, Tosca, Kiss Me Kate, and Faust. Now through August 11th, celebrating their 20th season. More details at utahfestival.org.
Welcome back to the second half of Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and not in studio, but on the line from Weber County is USU Extension Horticulturist Jerry Goodspeed. And we'll take any gardening question. We have been talking about shrubs. Join us at 1-800-826-1495. Email us a question at upraccess@gmail.com or tweet us a question at #AUGarden. Jerry, I've been looking through my book of Landscaping on the New Frontier. This is a book put out by USU Press. And it reminds me of some of the plants that I've wanted to get into my own landscape. And one of them I did a couple of years ago, and that was a big sagebrush. And you wouldn't normally think of, you know, sagebrush as looking really good in the landscape, but if it has a little bit of extra water, it seems to do really quite well.
Yeah, isn't that surprising? I'm always amazed that a lot of these plants that we call dry, when we do add a little bit of moisture to them, they do, the appearance changes a little bit, doesn't it? They tend to thicken up a little bit more, and it doesn't take a lot of water, just a little bit.
Yeah, just a little bit.
We can still conserve water with them, and yet they'll still look quite nice. Yeah, I agree.
And
nicer.
Would a sagebrush be good as kind of almost a host plant cover for, paintbrush?
Yes, it would. If you're trying to grow some castilleja or some paintbrush, it is one of the hosts. As a lot of people know, that plant is hemiparasitic. It normally has a root attachment to its host, and will it be able to get nutrients and some water as well from its host? And yeah, sagebrush is one of them. Yep.
I'm also looking. Are you familiar with sand sagebrush? This one looks a little bit different as well. It's really quite tiny. And then the mahogany, as you had mentioned, there's actually several different mahogany. There's the little leaf that we had discovered or had talked about. And then there's a curl leaf Mount mahogany.
Curl leaf is another one.
And then an alder leaf Mount mahogany. Are they all about the same as far as their height?
They are, and the appearance, yes.
Okay. What about shrubs that might do well in the shade? Any suggestions there?
Well, any of the one when you start to go into the mountains and look at what's in the understory, such things as the mountain or the Mahonia, what some people call Oregon grape. It's one that you find in an understory that does pretty good with a little bit of shade.
And are they typically a little more lower growing?
Yes.
Okay.
They'll get upwards of 2 to 3 feet. There is a lower growing one, a ground cover one, repens, that will just barely get 6 to 8 inches in that range.
What about a little leaf mock orange? They've got white flowers on them.
They do, and very fragrant, really nice. They'll get a little bit taller than that. They will, what we call that filtered sunlight, is kind of what you're talking about. And another very nice shrub.
Now, most of these, if you're bringing them from a mountain climate down into the valley floor, do you have to look at soil alkalinity? Is that going to be a problem for most of these?
That's a good question. excuse me. We're not just bringing them in a different soil, but the elevation changes can affect some of the plants, especially where you get more intense heat down here, a little bit longer season. And the soils. And yes, to answer your question, it can be a problem. You know, the most notorious plant that we struggle with is the aspen that people want to bring out of the mountains down into the valley, but we create we have an environment down here that they really don't like real well, and so we run into some problems with them. Not so much with the shrubs. Most of the shrubs adapt pretty well. It is true that we do want some drainage there. If you're throwing them into a heavy clay soil, little drainage, and you give them some water, they will get rut rots. They don't like that. What I tell most people with, if the more you know about the plant, the better you're able to grow it, because you're going to understand where it is native to, its habitat. You're going to understand, what kind of soil it likes. And if you can mimic that, as close as you can mimic that into your own yard, or know your own yard and your soil type and then find a plant that naturally grows in that type of a condition, you're going to have much better luck.
Would you recommend growing the plants in zones? So if you have an area that you know you don't want to water, then any plants that you put in there should be adapted to such.
Those hydro zones, those are the best things. Because, I've and you've seen this very often where you have a juniper surrounded by a bunch of annuals. And I want to tell people, and then they wonder why the juniper dies out. Well, because junipers are very drought tolerant, don't like to have water. They'll get root rots. And so if you can do that, if you can, on one sprinkler system, have your very dry plants and maybe only water them once a month, and then on another system have what we call your moderate watering plants, which maybe you're watering once a week and keeping them looking good and healthy, that's going to be so much better for the plants. And it gets back to, knowing just a little bit about the plant and knowing enough about it that you understand what plants are like plants. It means, what plants like the same type of watering scheme and then same type of soils and then making sure that they're all getting that basic same treatment.
Do you know, when we moved into our home 15 years ago, there were two junipers on the east side of our home and surrounded by grass, and the one never looked really, really good. And each year after then, it kept getting worse and worse, and I finally just pulled it out. So you think it's probably because it was in the grass and getting too much water?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, if it's getting the same amount of water that a turf or the grass is, then it will slowly die out. You know, it's kind of funny, those junipers are notorious for that, but they'll live a good 6 to 10 years, and then slowly you'll see one branch die, and then another branch die, and then another branch die, so they will slowly start to die off.
So I'm going to be expecting my other one to be going sometime soon.
Well, that's typical. I mean, there are some that adapt to it and live quite a while. I've got some, and I'm not a big juniper person. I love the ground cover junipers for filling in areas that, you know, they'll hold the weeds down. They don't take any water or much at all. So I'm a fan of them into those types of places. And there are some pretty ground cover junipers, you know, the blues and the yellows and the turquoise colors, and give you good fall color. But I use them sparingly, usually, in the landscape.
So what would you recommend for a shrub that you want to plant in the grass? I mean, obviously not one that's really drought tolerant and doesn't like the extra moisture.
Well, if you know, depending upon the size, there are such things as the red twig dogwoods, gold twig dogwoods, will do quite well with a little bit heavier moisture. You know, they're one of my favorite shrubs, too. There's the variegated leaf dogwoods. But they're plants that have multiple season interests. So, you know, the red twig, obviously, in the winter, but they do have a bloom on them. They have beautiful fall color. So they have three seasons. And the variegated leaf looks good throughout the summer. So there you have the four seasons that it has some interest into it. And if you prune them properly, or you're pruning them back, just pruning out the older canes, you know, they'll stay the size you want them. And they can adapt quite well to a little bit wetter location.
So you need to have the renewal pruning on the dogwood.
Anything with what we call a multiple trunk, where it has multiple trunks coming out of the ground, normally we're going to be doing some renewal pruning on it if we're trying to keep the size down. A lot of times with shrubs, people have a tendency when they get, you know, 5 feet and that's all the taller you want them, then you just cut them at 5 feet, but that's the worst thing you can do for them. It creates what you call that broom effect, where they'll get a lot of growth out of the top and then pretty soon nothing down below. And, it's not good for them. So, yeah, the renewal pruning where you're removing just the older canes, about a third or a quarter of the older canes every year, clear down to the base, keep them the same size, you get new growth out of them, and they just look a lot better.
So it's about every 3 years, then it sounds like, you know, you just each year you cut out the ones that are about 3 years old.
Yeah, 3 to 4 years old. Mm-hmm. That's what I do.
Okay.
That's what we do at most of the botanical center. Now, we have some in Ogden that we don't do that with. We leave them because we're using them as a block. So we want them to stay at about 7 to 8 feet, which means that we leave the cane a little bit longer just because we want the height on it. So it kind of depends. That's what's so cool about them. You can do a number of things with them.
We have our first caller. We have Keith from St. George. Hi, Keith. How can we help?
I was going to mention, you guys were talking about your grasshoppers.
Uh-huh.
My neighbor has chickens, and for years they've ranged over my ground. So we've got an acre between the two acres. And when we have the free-ranging chickens, you cannot find a grasshopper.
That's a great idea. That's true. They love those, don't they?
I was going to say you also can't find a melon in your garden.
That part you have to fence off. But we have pasture on both of our places, and to find a grasshopper, you may find it one day. You don't find it the next. But, you know, we had earwigs. We moved into the East Mill Creek area, and the area that year we moved in was infested with earwigs. You couldn't grow anything without them eating it up. And I sent off what were called Chinese praying mantis, which were, and I don't see them advertised anymore, but they were huge. And within 3 years, you couldn't find an earwig anywhere, and you couldn't find grasshoppers in the whole neighborhood. And East Mill Creek's pretty woody, so the praying mantis did really well. But after that point, we just never had an earwig in our garden. And we went out and watched them munch on these things.
You know, you bring up a really good point about using nature with the chickens or with the praying mantids or whatever it is to control the insects. Now, a lot of times they don't do, it sounds like you're having great luck with it, especially with the chickens, but sometimes with the insects, they don't control them 100%, but they control them where we need them, down to a level where you don't see them or down to a level where they're really not a problem. And that's part. And if you can do that, man, that's the best thing you can do.
Well, it's cheaper to reorder praying mantis, you know, because many times, by the time they finally get full grown, you've got a major infestation. But if you reorder them every couple years, you got enough praying mantis on your property that they pretty well keep the resident population of insects down.
Cool.
Great.
That's great.
Thanks for your phone call.
All right.
All right.
Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. I've often wondered, kind of changing the subject here, but along the line of what Keith was talking about, I used to see praying mantids around here all the time, and I haven't seen one in a couple of years. I mean, are the population's that cyclical with them?
You know, again, I'm not an expert on those. I don't know.
I'll have Diane Alston in next week so I can ask her about that as well.
Yeah, she would know. I don't. I'd just be guessing, so I don't know.
Going back to shrubs, I wanted to ask, some of these specialty shrubs that you think you would be able to find because they are in our own climate, growing in the mountains or in Utah, you can't find them in the stores necessarily. So where do you go to look?
And that's a good point. There are some nurseries that are starting to carry them more and more. And you kind of have to call around. You'll probably never find them in the box stores, you know, the Home Depots, the Lowe's, places like that. But where you will find them is, especially if you go down and ask, you know, at some of your local independent nurseries, and go down and ask them and say, you know, this is, I'd like to try some natives. What do you have? Or call around before you go and find out which nurseries do carry some of these natives, because we grow them at the Botanical Center in Kaysville, and we do supply them to some of the local nurseries as well. So I do know that they're out there, and I do know that some people are starting to carry them more and more.
Now, I suppose we should have these guys as underwriters, but I have no connection to them whatsoever. But I know that in northern Utah, Willard Bay Gardens has got quite a large selection of native and drought-tolerant plants.
Perennials, yeah.
And then Wildland Nursery. Down in, I think it's Joseph, just south of Cedars, south of Richfield.
Richfield,
has quite a large selection.
She does. She does a nice job down there, too. So there are a lot of, and as I say, not just those, but there's more and more of them now, of the nurseries that are starting to carry some as well.
And I suppose if you go in and say, I'd like to have these plants, the more people they get asking for them, and then they're going to find them and bring them in.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And it is getting to that point. I mean, you know, we're seeing it more and more where there's becoming a demand. We grow, you know, a lot of these natives here on the Botanical Center, and we're having more and more of the nurseries come to us looking for them. So I think the word is getting out, and I think as people start to see them and see the beauty of them, especially if we have a couple more summers like this, we're going to find more and more of those, more and more of a demand on some of the beautiful plants that we have that will grow natively and will help us conserve the moisture we need to.
Or we have our next caller on the line. We have Ilona from Logan. Hi, Ilona. How can we help?
Hi, yes. We have a very small garden, but the back of it is along the river. And I planted a bunch of vegetables in cedar tubs. And I was really glad. There's a long story to it, but I won't bore you. For the first time since we live here, there is sun back there, which there never was before. And so I'm not quite used to planting things in that area, but it's very, very sunny, completely open and exposed. And I planted vegetables like squash, and squash generally grows pretty easily, especially zucchini. And they're just burning up in the sun back there. And I want to protect the earth. I'm guessing that a good idea would be to protect the earth. We do have lots of mulch on top of the soil, and the soil is very soft. And
let me ask you a question. Where'd you get the mulch from?
Just from around the yard. It's just yard clippings, and we have a composter.
And so you've been composting some too?
Yeah.
And how about the soil? What's the soil like? Is it just the native soil?
It's commercially prepared soil. Store.
And is this your first year of having the sun everything out there?
Right. Everything's brand new back there.
I'll tell you my opinion. What happens quite often when we establish it, especially with some of the prepared soils or media mixes and things and compost, is that we run into some salt damage. And so the salts will aggravate the heat problems because it reduces the ability of the plant to move moisture. And I wonder sometimes when I hear what you're saying, and I've heard it a number of times, if it's just that first year where we're getting some high levels of salts into those soils, and that's why the plants are burning up.
And the salts are coming from the soil itself?
Well, usually we bring it in when we bring in compost or when we do compost, or it's a natural byproduct that we'll have, or fertilizers have it. And so normally the first year, you know, until we get it to leach through and until you're working it in regularly, I will see the first year or two some problems with that, yes.
Okay.
If you want to be sure, what you can do is just take some soil samples and send them off to the lab there at USU, or go down to your extension office and talk to them there in Logan, and they'll get you a soil kit. And I think it's $14, and then they will analyze it for you and tell you if that's the problem.
Okay.
But it wouldn't surprise me, and that's probably where I would start with that.
Okay. Is there any? Do you think it would help at all to somehow shield those cedar tubs to provide more shade in the hot sun afternoon?
I don't, because I think that those crops, they'll grow in full sun. We've got them here on the garden. We've got large vegetable areas, and we grow them in full sun with no shade at all, and they just do fine. They just thrive.
Okay.
So make sure that you give them the deep water, and make sure that. And I would get a soil sample and just see. That lets you at least know, is there a deficiency there? Is there too much salt? And it gets you a very good starting point.
Okay, very good. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Ilona.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
If you'd like to join our conversation, we only have about 6 minutes left of the program. Our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495. You can also tweet us a question at hashtag AUGarden and also send us an email at upraccess@gmail.com. As I'm looking through this book, Jerry, I'm seeing a few more that look maybe like they're more flowering. Are you familiar with Martin Mountain Lilac? This is one I've not heard of before.
Nor have I. I'm not real familiar, but if it's a typical... If it's related to the lilacs, we know that they're very drought-tolerant, and they do quite well.
So even just regular lilacs in your landscape are somewhat drought-tolerant?
Oh, yeah. If you go, you know, in Weber County and sometimes in Davis County, go out to the west where the old homesteads are, maybe they've been abandoned for a number of years, three plants are still growing, the junipers, the crab apples, and the lilacs.
I have noticed that. Now that you mention it, it's like the lilacs like the last thing that's still growing around the old homestead.
Yep, they'll grow for many, many years without being watered.
Have you ever heard of little leaf mock orange?
I have. Mm-hmm.
And do
That's
you see
a nice plant.
You see that in the landscapes?
I do more and more. Yeah, and we've grown some of that here, trying to introduce it and get it pushed a little bit, just because of beautiful plant, nice flower, good aroma. I think it's one that we need to be putting into the landscape.
We have our next caller from Bear Lake. We have Judy. Hi, Judy. How can we help you?
Well, we have these lilacs that we put in about 8 years ago when we first moved here, and I have put Miracle-Gro on them faithfully, like they say I'm supposed to, every 3 months, and they just don't seem to flower very much. In fact, the ones in the very front of our house haven't had any flowers at all this year. What am I doing?
How much shade do they get?
Let's see. The ones in the very front are getting morning sun. And the ones on the side yard probably have, they get morning sun too. But as the sun goes across, it's probably a little bit less.
I find with lilacs a couple things. One is too much shade will reduce blossom quite a bit. And they'll get kind of leggy as well.
Yeah,
and
I put them back last year.
Uh-huh.
And my husband said they were upset with me, and that's why they didn't blossom, because I trimmed them back too much.
Well, I don't know if they're upset with you. I think they're happy with you. They're just getting some new wood to bloom.
Uh-huh.
They will bloom on year-old wood. That's why we prune them usually after they bloom.
Do they need to be trimmed?
On older wood is what I meant to say, not just year-old.
What did you say?
They'll bloom on older wood.
They bloom on older wood.
Yeah.
So the ones in the very front of our house kind of end up covering our front little window that we have a window seat with a window there, and I don't want to completely cover that window with them, and that's why I trimmed them down. I really haven't trimmed the other ones, but they're not blooming either.
Well, the ones that you're pruning down, my opinion would be maybe to replace them with a smaller plant or a dwarf lilac, you know, like that are out there.
Like a Miss Kim?
Like a Miss Kim, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But they're still going to have a shade in the afternoon.
Yeah, I was going to say, if they're still shady, there's still going to be a problem. Most lilacs do best with full sun.
Okay.
And other than that, I'm not sure what to tell you. As far as the Miracle-Gro goes, my own opinion is that's probably a waste of money.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't feel, I mean, it's a water-soluble nutrient-based product that's probably in the soil for 7 days at the most. And
oh, really?
You mix it up with water, and so it moves pretty quick. That's why you have to apply it so often.
Yeah, they said every 3 months.
Yeah, so my own opinion would be a good fertilization in the spring with just a cheaper all-purpose fertilizer would probably be,
and it doesn't
will be every bit as good as what you're getting out of the Miracle-Gro.
Okay, and it doesn't have to be like for flowering plants.
No, they'll do. I have some lilacs in my backyard I never fertilize, and they do just fine.
And they do fine. They must be in full sun all day.
They are. Mm-hmm. They are.
They are. I have one more question.
Sure.
I have a wisteria, two wisteria plants, and they're going over an arbor, and they're on the north side of my house, so that they have the afternoon sun. The one is facing south, and the other one is facing north. The one that's facing south is nice and green, and the one that's facing north, you know, that's on that side, is pale. It's like pale green, and they're the same plant. Is there some reason for that?
Probably. But you can ask me what that reason is. I'm not sure.
Do they? What kind of fertilizer would they need? The same kind?
Just a good nitrogen in the spring, normally. You might want to try a little bit of iron on that one on the north.
Yeah, it sounds like to me is the iron is deficient.
Yeah, I'd get a good chelated iron and see what you can do.
Yeah, the funny thing about it is they've both been fertilized in the same exact way.
And you know, there could be something in the soil we don't see. There could be some damage on that one. And there's some things that, and it could be one of those things, one of those 10% of the times where I haven't a clue what it is. The plant is just being weird.
We've reached the end of our time. Thank you very much for your phone call. And
thank you for answering my questions.
You bet. Thanks for calling in. And Jerry, thank you for joining us on the program.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Access Utah. Jerry Goodspeed, Weber County's Extension Horticulturist, has been on the line with us for this hour of Access Utah. Stay with us for the next week, and we'll have Diane Olson in to talk about insects.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.